Hello, and welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Rosemary Onkwe, bringing you readings from the following publications. WISN/ABC TV, The Voice, Blavity, Ebony, The Root, The Griot, News One, and The Black Wall Street Times. Today we'll begin reading from the Black Wall Street Times with an article titled "The Black Women of Black Wall Street, Forgotten Architects of Black History," written by Lisa Goshen, G-O-S-H-O-N, February 14th, 2025. While the world remembers the men who laid the foundation of Black Wall Street, Black women were just as instrumental in its rise. This week, I'm excited to shine a light on the incredible women who redefine what it means to be a Black queen and superhero, two words that capture the essence of who we are. By now, many are familiar with the Black Wall Street, the first Black-owned community in the U.S. to reach a level of success previously unseen before the abolition of slavery on January 31, 1865, which symbolized Black entrepreneurship, community, and self-reliance. However, as is often the case, the contributions of Black women are frequently overshadowed by the broader challenges faced by the Black community. Just like Black women in 2025, the Black women of Black Wall Street are a testament to the strength of community, the power of resilience, and the unmatched spirit of Black womanhood. Despite the adversaries and challenges these women faced both personally and professionally, they built empires, and in doing so, created a legacy that continues to inspire. Even after the horrors of the Tulsa Race Massacre, when their businesses were destroyed and their lives shattered, they found ways to rebuild because the Black women of Black Wall Street knew that their power wasn't in their material wealth, but in their ability to unite, to rise, and to create again. They were the visionaries and warriors whose determination and brilliance were the heartbeat of one of the most prosperous Black communities in American history. One of the most striking aspects of their lives was how they seamlessly blended entrepreneurship with social activism. The beauty salons they owned weren't just places to get a haircut or a facial. They were sanctuaries where women shared ideas, supported each other, and built a collective sense of purpose. The restaurants and hotels they managed were more than just establishments. They were the gathering spots for intellectual exchange, political discussion, and cultural solidarity. They were the architects of the Black Wall Street, and their impact is woven into the very fabric of its history. Fast forward to today, and Black women are undergoing a transformation driven by the rapid pace of systemic changes. As we witness the erosion of civil rights and the loss of women's rights, Black women are navigating these challenges with perseverance, finding ways to avoid obstacles and move forward with confidence and determination. However, there is still work to be done. Black women must embrace the same mindset that the women of Black Wall Street embodied. We need to learn how to tap into the strength of community, supporting one another fully, fostering sisterhood, and uniting to unlock the economic power and wealth needed for real ownership. This is especially crucial in the beauty industry, where we spend $9.4 billion annually, but control less than 5% of the market. When we look back to 1920, the landscape for Black-owned beauty brands was strikingly different. One of the most notable sectors where Black women excelled in Black Wall Street was beauty and personal care. Beauty parlors, barbershops, and hair salons were among the most successful business in the district. These spaces were not just about physical appearance, but also about creating a sense of belonging and fostering self-esteem in an environment where African Americans were often subjected to dehumanizing stereotypes. Women used beauty and grooming businesses as a means of economic independence and as places where community bonds could be strengthened. Black women who built empires. Mary E. Jones Parrish was a talented educator, journalist, and businesswoman who ran a beauty salon. She was also one of the key figures in documenting the Greenwood community's tragedy during the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre. Parrish's beauty business was a cornerstone for local women who sought to enhance their physical appearance and gain financial independence. Then there's Alma Wilson, another well-known figure and a respected businesswoman who owned one of the leading beauty salons in the area. Her salon catered to the women of Greenwood, giving them a place of relaxation, rejuvenation, and empowerment. Her role as a business owner allowed her to have a considerable influence on the local community and became a meeting place for women's social and professional activities. Miss Lottie O'Neill was an entrepreneur who owned and operated a well-known hotel. The hotel became a popular gathering spot for visitors from other parts of the nation. Her establishment became an iconic symbol of success for women in the business world of Black Wall Street. Although best known as the first African-American woman to hold a pilot's license, Bessie Coleman's achievements transcended her aviation career. Her entrepreneurial spirit, linked to her role as a public figure and an inspiration for women, influenced other Black women to pursue independence through business ventures, breaking barriers in industries previously closed to them. Survivors. Then there are the two remaining survivors of Black Wall Street, both of whom just so happened to be women and first-hand witnesses to one of the most horrific acts of violence against Black people in U.S. history. Viola Fletcher and Lessie Benningfield Randall, both 110 years old. Miss Fletcher was just 7 years old when a white mob burned the Greenwood district of Tulsa, Oklahoma, to the ground. She is one of the oldest known living survivors of what is now known as the Tulsa Massacre. The fire, smoke, and violence from that mob created vivid memories of the night of May 30th, 1921, memories Fletcher can still recount with sobering clarity and strength even a century later. In July 2021, Fletcher's memory, "Don't Let Them Bury My Story," was published, making her the oldest woman in the world to write a memoir. The book details the massacre, what happened in its aftermath, and the life she's lived since, a life still affected by the tragedy. Mother Randall was also a young girl at the time of the massacre, bearing witness to the horrors that engulfed Greenwood. These two women have survived and witnessed a century of social and political struggles, and their strength continues to inspire us all. Cultural and social impact. Black women entrepreneurs didn't just shape the economic landscape of Black Wall Street. They also influenced the culture and social life of Greenwood. Their businesses offered spaces for networking, activism, and a sense of shared pride. These women fostered a community where Black residents were able to build trust in each other and create strong alliances. They also became integral voices in advocating for civil rights and Black empowerment, and many were involved in local civic and social organizations that supported both women and the broader African-American community. Fast forward to 2025, and we're witnessing a resurgence of those same businesses focused on social, political, health, and wealth initiatives. More importantly, we're responsible for setting the tone and modeling behaviors favorable for young Black girls who often need mentors. Legacy and continuing influence. The contributions of Black women to the success of Black Wall Street have often been overshadowed by the larger narrative of male business owners or the traumatic events of the 1921 massacre. However, the women of Black Wall Street laid the groundwork for later generations of Black entrepreneurs like myself and others, whose influence continues today. From the beauty industry to real estate and banking, the entrepreneurial spirit of women in Black Wall Street left an indelible mark on American business history. Through their courage, hard work, and commitment to the betterment of their community, the women of Black Wall Street helped create a beacon of Black success, a legacy that continues to inspire generations of entrepreneurs today. As we move forward in 2025 and beyond, we must continue to celebrate and uplift the legacy of those unsung heroes whose strength, wisdom, and entrepreneurial spirit continue to shape the world today. This article was titled, "The Black Women of Black Wall Street, Forgotten Architects of Black History," written by Lisa Goshen, The Black Wall Street Times, February 14th, 2025. Next, an article from African American Spirit, Black History, featuring Charlotte Hawkins Brown. Charlotte Hawkins Brown was born in Henderson, North Carolina, on June 11, 1883. She was an author, educator, and founder of the Palmer Memorial Institute in Sedalia, North Carolina. In 1901, 18-year-old Hawkins accepted a teaching position and taught Black children at Bethany Congregational Church in Sedalia, North Carolina. In 1902, Hawkins, with the assistance of her mentor, Alice Freeman Palmer, established the Alice Freeman Palmer Institute, instructing Black children between the elementary and junior college level. Charlotte Hawkins Brown continued her own formal education while teaching, and she received several honorary degrees from Simmons College, Temple University, and Wesley College. As her dedication to her students and education became nationally recognized, she traveled in circles that included Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, and the great educator Mary McLeod Bethune. Besides her work as an educator, Brown also became a talented essayist and a short story writer. Throughout her adult life, she was a dedicated anti-segregationist and an advocate for Black cultural pride and identity. Charlotte Hawkins Brown died in 1961. Soon afterwards, North Carolina designated the Alice Freeman Palmer Institute the first historical landmark of North Carolina for a Black person. The next article is titled, "Taylor Page Gives a Rare Glimpse into Her Health Journey with Endometriosis, a Really Violent Illness," written by Kay Wicker, W-I-C-K-E-R, The Griot, March 5, 2025. Actress Taylor Page opens up about living with endometriosis during March, which is Endometriosis Awareness Month. Taylor Page is marking March Endometriosis Awareness Month by shedding light on her journey living with the painful condition. On Tuesday, the 34-year-old actress gave followers a closer look at her life with the condition in an Instagram post that included a carousel of images of her recovery process interwoven with other shots from throughout the year. the lifelong journey of healing, she began in the post's lengthy caption, shows up in women who have had to hold a lot of pain in. Pain, heavy bleeding, adhesions, forcing oneself to take on and take in pain that doesn't belong to you. The Beverly Hills Cop Axel F. actress noted that she found some recent inspiration from a post by the Period Lab discussing how the body can create walls and adhesions similar to the way the mind can respond to trauma. This has taken me a long time to learn, the Zola star continued. Goodness, the self-betrayal and abuse I've internalized and would ruminate in. Those not for you benefit from this confusion. I've transmitted so much, but old habits die hard. A really violent illness that went undiagnosed for 20 years, but caused me so much agony and turmoil. The actress added that she had surgery on her colon, bladder, and rectum in the fall of 2023 that lasted 4 hours. Before that, however, she recalled the pain caused her endometriosis would make me see stars. Throwing up every month, sometimes couldn't drive, she added. The worst is how much you gaslight yourself. It's almost like there's no way you're hurting this much. It definitely psychologically does something to you. Because it's like you, and no one around believes you. No one around you believes the pain you're in. Endometriosis, which causes tissue that would normally grow inside the uterus to grow outside of the uterus, and can lead to intense pain and heavy bleeding during menstrual cycles, as well as fertility issues, impacts roughly 10% of women, according to Johns Hopkins. The anxiety of next month, Paige wrote, so many times I've ruined a costume or a good pair of jeans. In high school, my khaki uniform skirts. Diagnosing and treating the condition, as Paige experienced in her journey, often requires surgery, according to the Cleveland Clinic. All of the diseased tissue is removed and then examined and properly assessed. Often thought of as a white woman's disease, endometriosis remains undiagnosed, particularly in black women. According to the National Library of Medicine, early associations of the disease as one that impacted high-achieving, affluent white women who were late to conceive have been hard to correct in the overall view of the condition. In her post, Paige noted, I learned over the last few years that endo is anger turned on yourself. You're literally inflamed. That tracked for me. So many women are going through it, okay? Be gentle with us. Noting that she is grateful for what she's been able to turn around in herself over the last few years. Paige, who is married to designer Rivington Starchild, said, I thank my body, I thank my husband, I thank my dear sister, Elizabeth Halpern, who has taught me so much, my true health mentor. Her gratitude list also includes blood work, acupuncture, clean water, protein, saunas, and a calm nervous system, thanks in part to a healthy partnership. It's not just one thing, it's a whole lot of things, and I'm thankful. We live in a time where we can share and help each other, she wrote towards the end of the post. I love you, she concluded. This article was titled, Taylor Paige Gives a Rare Glimpse into Her Health Journey with Endometriosis, a Really Violent Illness, written by Kay Wicker, The Griot, March 5th, 2025. The next article is from Blavity and is titled, Road Toll Scam Texts Persist. Officials warn of Easy Pass fraud and more in these states. Written by Tomas Casajon, TOMASKASSAHUN. March 6, 2025. Officials across multiple states are warning people about a scam involving fraudulent road toll payment requests. The scam has been reported in Ohio and Virginia. where drivers are receiving text messages from scammers claiming they owe unpaid toll fees. On Monday, the Virginia Department of Transportation, VDOT, issued a warning via Facebook, reminding drivers that government agencies will never send toll bills through text messages. Virginia DMV doesn't do this. Do not click links or provide financial information through text messages, the department wrote. According to ABC 13, the scam prompts recipients to follow a link and pay an alleged unpaid toll. A similar scheme is occurring in Ohio, where drivers have been receiving identical text messages following the state's implementation of its EasyPass tolling system in 2024, per the Columbus Dispatch. Following the launch of the new system, Ohio provided drivers with a grace period to adjust, suspending all late fees, collections, and registration holds for unpaid tolls. When the grace period ended in February, the Turnpike resumed issuing late fees for unpaid tolls. Officials in Ohio continue to emphasize that toll bills are always sent by mail, never via text messages. Drivers are being urged to avoid clicking any suspicious links and remain cautious, as scammers often create a false sense of urgency to pressure victims into making hasty decisions. Officials advise people to verify toll charges by contacting the tolling agency directly through an official phone number or legitimate government website. In Ohio, drivers can access the Ohio Turnpike website or contact EasyPass via www.easypassoh.com or by calling 440-971-2222. Drivers can report unwanted text messages by forwarding them to 7726 spam. The FBI also advises reporting suspicious activity through its Crime Complaint Center. This article was titled, Road Toll Scam Texts Persist. Officials warn of EasyPass fraud and more in these states. Written by Tomas Casajon, Blavity, March 6, 2025. The next article is from The Voice and is titled, Best Exercises for Hip Arthritis. Written by The Voice Health News, March 5, 2025. When you have hip arthritis, especially if it's painful, you may think you need to limit your activities, but your joints and overall fitness benefit from staying active. When we're talking about hip arthritis, we're usually talking about osteoarthritis, as that's most common, says physical therapist Justin Nessel, N-E-S-S-E-L, D-B-T. This is an inflammatory disease of the joint, and it gets worse over time, changing the shape of the hip joint and making it harder and more painful to move. Hip arthritis can happen to anyone, but it's more common in people who had a significant injury to the hip joint in the past. It's a myth that running or high-impact activities in moderation can cause arthritis, he shares. It's only if you're doing these activities in excess that they may contribute to the development of arthritis. But on their own, they don't cause arthritis. Dr. Nessel explained why movement is good for your joints and which type of exercises are best for hip arthritis. What are the best exercises for hip arthritis? As arthritis causes changes to your hip joint, it affects how your joint functions, and you can lose your range of motion. Walking and going up and down stairs can become more painful and challenging. Dr. Nessel says exercise can't reverse arthritis, but it can help you to maintain range of motion in your hip joint, strong muscles around your hip, which help support the joint and improve your balance. He adds that there is no one best exercise for hip arthritis. It's most important to pick something you like to do, as long as it doesn't cause you more pain, he says. Good options for exercise when you have hip arthritis are 1. Walking. Walking includes low-grade impact, which is really healthy for your hips and all your joints, said Dr. Nessel. It uses all the muscles in your legs and trunk, so it's a good bang for your buck for general health and fitness. Walking can be as simple as putting on a comfortable pair of shoes and heading out the door. You can also try Nordic walking with poles, rucking to add some weight resistance, walking in nature, walking while you work with a walking pad, walking in place. But Dr. Nessel recognizes that some people just don't enjoy walking, and depending on where you live, you may not have a good place to walk. No worries, you have several other hip-friendly options for staying active. 2. Aquatic exercise. Exercising in a pool can be great for your joints because the buoyancy in water takes some of the pressure off. If your hips are sensitive to pressure when you have arthritis, aquatic exercise can offload some of the weight you feel when you're on land, explains Dr. Nessel. It can allow you to move longer than you might be able to tolerate on land. Aquatic exercise, sometimes called hydrotherapy, that can benefit hip arthritis include deep water running, swimming, walking in water, and water aerobics. Cycling. Cycling is a good alternative for people who don't like to walk, notes Dr. Nessel. It's a great way to keep your legs moving, but with a smaller range of motion than some other exercises that may be more tolerable for some people with hip issues. Even with a smaller range of motion, the resistance of a bike still allows you to get the strengthening benefit from exercise. There are plenty of ways to work cycling into your routine, including biking outdoors, using a stationary bike at home or the gym, trying a spin class. Strength training. Strength training is one of the least used but most beneficial forms of exercise for hip arthritis, states Dr. Nessel. He recommends strength training 2 or 3 times a week, making sure not to work the same muscles 2 days in a row. Strengthening the muscles around the hip joint helps your hips work better and with less pain, he says. Weight-bearing exercise is important because walking or cardio doesn't build enough muscle or help you preserve strength. Challenging your muscles' ability to move weight is important, especially as we get older. As we age, we lose muscle mass and strength every year if we're not doing some kind of resistance training to offset that loss, he explains. Strength training can be any movement with added resistance, and you don't have to lift huge weights to benefit. Try using your own body weight with calisthenics or isometric exercise, resistant bands, suspension training, weightlifting with kettlebells, barbells or dumbbells, and Pilates, yoga or stretching. Yoga and stretching are excellent ways to preserve and build flexibility, says Dr. Nessel. Yoga is a low-impact mind-body exercise that can help with balance, flexibility, and strength. The key with this or any other exercise is not pushing through pain because that can make arthritis worse, he notes. Dr. Nessel emphasizes that you can still do a broad range of activities when you have hip arthritis. Don't be afraid to move, he says. It's less about avoiding activities and more about finding exercise that works for you. Bottom line, whatever exercise you choose, aim for something you enjoy. If you'd like specific exercises tailored to your preferences and fitness level, a physical therapist can be your guide. This story was originally published by Cleveland Clinic. This article was titled Best Exercises for Hip Arthritis, was written by Voice Health News, The Voice, March 5th, 2025. Next, an article from News One titled, What Are Tariffs and How Will They Impact America? Written by Amit Rajit A. Amitabhaya. Amitrajeet. Batabyal. March 4th, 2025. The world is lurching ever closer to a full-blown trade war as the U.S., China, Europe, Canada, and Mexico talk tariffs and retaliation. President Donald Trump made the initial salvo back in March when he placed duties on steel and aluminum. These actions have prompted significant concern and discussion about the wisdom of this action. As an economist who shares some of those concerns, I believe it's important to first understand what a tariff actually is and does before we can determine whether Trump's new trade barriers are good or bad. Two kinds of tariffs. A tariff, simply put, is a tax levied on an imported good. There are two types. A unit or specific tariff is a tax levied as a fixed charge for each unit of a good that is imported. For instance, $300 per ton of imported steel. An ad valorem tariff is levied as a proportion of the value of imported goods. An example is a 20% tariff on imported automobiles. Both tariffs act in similar ways. Tariffs are one of the oldest trade policy instruments, with their use dating back to at least the 18th century. Historically, the main objective of a tariff was to raise revenue. In fact, before ratifying the 16th Amendment in 1913 and formally creating the income tax, the U.S. government raised most of its revenue from tariffs. Even so, the main purpose of a tariff these days tends to be about protecting particular domestic industries from foreign competition alongside raising revenue. Examining a tariff's impact. The impact of a tariff depends on whether the levying country is large or small, not in terms of size, but the potency of its trade and ability to influence world prices. Ghana, for example, roughly the size of Minnesota, with a population similar to Texas, is the world's top exporter of cocoa. The Netherlands, meanwhile, slightly smaller than New Jersey, is the commodity's biggest importer. As such, both countries' trade policies can have a significant impact on the price of cocoa on global markets. So if the Netherlands were to levy a tariff of imports of Ghanaian cocoa to protect nascent and currently imaginary industry of Dutch cocoa bean growers, there would generally be three effects. First, the price of import good cocoa would rise, making it more costly for domestic consumers of the product. This would be bad news for Dutch chocolatiers. The Netherlands is the world's biggest exporter of cocoa butter and citizens who eat a lot of chocolate. But it'd be good news for companies in the domestic import competing industry. The experimental Dutch farmers growing cocoa plants in a greenhouse, because the good they produce is now cheaper than the import, and so the cocoa butter makers would buy more of the local variety. Second, because the tariff levying country is large, it drives down the export price of the good in question. So the pre-tariff price at which Ghana can export cocoa to the Netherlands declines, Ghanaian growers and producers make less money, and the country's economy is hurt. Economists call this a terms of trade gain for the country imposing the tariff. Such a tariff ensures that the price of cocoa in the Netherlands does not rise by the entire amount of the tariff. Finally, the overall volume of trade in the product between the countries involved decreases because the demand for and the supply of the good falls. If the tariff levying country is small, however, there are only two effects. The goods price will go up, domestic consumers will pay more. While producers will sell more, the country's trade of the product will decline. The action will have no impact on global prices. Benefits and costs. For a large country, the benefits of a tariff are mixed. Consumers, whether businesses like Dutch cocoa butter makers or individuals who enjoy a tasty bar of dark chocolate, face higher prices and hence are the losers. The industry being protected, however, benefits by becoming more competitive and selling more of its wares. In addition, the government will gain a new source of revenue. The net effects boils down to whether any gains in the terms of a trade are greater than the resulting efficiency loss. That is, how much the tariff artificially distorts consumption and production decisions in negative ways. If the magnitude of the terms of the trade gain is larger than that of the efficiency loss, then the country benefits from the tariff. If not, it loses. For a small country with no market impact, the terms of trade gain is zero. Hence, a tariff unambiguously makes it worse off. Political economy of tariffs. The fact that a large country can, and in some cases, be better off with a tariff has led some to suggest that such nations ought to, when necessary, levy optimal tariffs against their trade partners. An optimal tariff maximizes the difference between the terms of the trade gain and the efficiency loss, and hence is essentially a beggar thy neighbor trade policy. In other words, the problem with such strategic tariffs is that in addition to frequently being illegal, they are not implemented in a vacuum. Aggrieved trade partners are likely to respond with appropriate tariffs or other trade policy instruments of their own. These kind of sequential tit-for-tat actions can easily degenerate into a trade war. This is in part why trade economists are typically against restricted trade and for free trade. This article was titled, "What Are Tariffs? And how will they impact America?" A tariff, simply put, is a tax levied on an imported good. Written by Amit Rajit A. Batabayal, Rochester Institute of Technology, News 1, March 4th, 2025. The next article is titled, "Aside from Southern University, other prestigious HBCU marching bands you should be checking out." Written by Noah A. McGee, MCGEE, The Root, February 10, 2025. There's been a long history of HBCU bands performing at the Super Bowl, the most watched sporting event of the year. Although they didn't take the stage with Kendrick Lamar during his much-anticipated halftime performance, this year, Southern University's marching band still did their thing for a crowd at the Caesars Superdome in New Orleans during the pregame show. But they aren't the only marching band that has performed in front of some impressive crowds. Here are more of the most talented and prestigious HBCU bands in the land. Grambling State University, GRAMBLING. Founded in 1926, the world-famed Tiger Marching Band performed in the first two Super Bowls in NFL history. They're continuing that long tradition by performing at the pregame show for this year's Super Bowl in their backyard. Florida A&M University. Famously known as the Marching 100, this beloved HBCU marching band was founded in 1892. It performed in front of several presidents, including at Bill Clinton's presidential inauguration in 1993 and Barack Obama's inauguration in 2009. The Marching 100 has performed at several other worldwide events, including the Super Bowl, the Summer Olympics, even the bicentennial celebration of the French Revolution in 1989. Southern University. With maybe the coolest nickname for a marching band, the Human Jukebox, the Southern University, with maybe the coolest name for a marching band, the Human Jukebox, the Southern University has also performed at several huge events, including the Super Bowl halftime show 6 times. This renowned band has also been included in music videos for popular artists, most recently Lizzo's Good as Hell in 2016. Alabama State University. The mighty Marching Hornets are one of the most visible bands in the country. They have performed at events that millions have viewed. They were featured in Homecoming, a film by Beyoncé, and also performed at the 2019 Rose Parade before the Rose Bowl. The main dance line is known as the Sensational Stingettes, but they also have a dance line for only plus-size women called the Honeybees, B-E-E-Z. Jackson State University. Exquisitely named the Sonic Boom of the South, Jackson State University's band has also been on the Super Bowl stage. In 2024, they were included in Usher's excellent halftime performance in Las Vegas. They also performed at Biden's presidential inauguration parade. North Carolina A&T University. Known as the Blue Gold Marching Machine, North Carolina A&T's band was recently ranked as the best HBCU band in the land in October 2024. Texas Southern University. The Pride of Hill Country has performed at NFL games like several other bands on this list, but in 2003, they became the first American marching band to perform at a professional soccer game in Mexico. Norfolk State University. Although it is one of the youngest bands on this list, it was founded in 1975, the Spartan legend still has performed for some incredible crowds, including an Obama presidential campaign rally and the Mardi Gras at the Rex Parade. Tennessee State University. The Aristocrat of Band has something that almost no other marching band in the country has: a Grammy. At the 65th Annual Grammy Awards, they took home an award for Best Roots Gospel Album for their contribution to the 2022 album, The Urban Hymnal. Howard University. There aren't many places the Showtime Marching Band hasn't performed. They've showed out for several NFL teams, including the Pittsburgh Steelers, Philadelphia Eagles, and the Baltimore Ravens. They also performed at the inaugural parade for President Obama and the Macy's Thanksgiving Parade in New York City. Hampton University Band. Howard University's main rival, Hampton, also has a formidable band. Like their rival, they've also performed for President Obama and have even taken their talents overseas, playing at the New Year's Parade in Rome, Italy. Alcorn State University. The Sounds of Dynamite, S-O-D, is the marching band for Alcorn State University in Mississippi. The name of the dance line is the world-renowned Golden Girls. The dance line also refers to themselves as the mother of HBCU dance lines, since they are the first ones to be included with an HBCU marching band. Alabama A&M University. The Show Band of the South has been around since 1890, making them one of the oldest HBCU bands in the country. They were the first HBCU band to ever perform at the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in New York. University of Arkansas, Pine Bluff. This underrated HBCU marching band doesn't get enough love, but they're still just as talented as every other band on this list. Last year, M4 performed at WWE's Bad Blood Premium Live event at the State Farm Arena in Atlanta. This article was titled, "Aside from Southern University, Other Prestigious Marching Bands You Should Be Checking Out," by Noah A. McGee, The Root, February 10th, 2025. The next article is titled, "Ireland's Earliest Inhabitants Were Black People with Blue Eyes," written by Shannon Dawson, News One, March 17th, 2025. Black faces show up on every continent in every era of world history, including places like Ireland. Researchers are discovering new information about the earliest inhabitants of Ireland, and some data suggests that the first settlers were black people with blue eyes, according to the Irish Times. In April 2021, geneticist Dr. Lara Cassidy told the publication that forensic data revealed surprising information about black historic Irish people who were known to be hunters and gatherers. They lived on the island for nearly 4,000 years before settled farmers took over. The discovery was largely explored in a documentary called The Burren, Heart of Stone, last year, where scientists developed a large genetic database of Irish genomes to help uncover more information about Ireland's first natives. We now know from ancient genomes that farming was accompanied by a whole group of people moving into the continent from the region now known as modern Turkey, Cassidy explained. The black settlers were known to gather shellfish along the Burren, a karst landscape of bedrock incorporating a vast cracked pavement of glacial-era limestone located in the region of County Clare, which is southwest of Ireland. They eventually moved inland to hunt wild boars and gather hazelnuts. Scientists believe that farmers who migrated into the region during the Neolithic period may have driven the original settlers out of what they brought: cattle, sheep, goats, pottery, and new housing structures. Dr. Cassidy believes that they may have had lighter skin than the hunter-gatherers. There could have been violence. This would have been quite a dramatic colonization event, she added. Back in 2018, geneticists from the University College London and the Natural History Museum found a Mesolithic skeleton dating back to 1903 that they believed had dark to black skin with blue eyes and curly hair, the Irish Post first reported. Dr. Dan Bradley, a researcher behind the historic discovery, said that the skeleton, which was later dubbed Cheddar Man, could suggest that Europeans may have evolved years later on the island. The earliest Irish would have been the same as Cheddar Man and would have had darker skin than we have today, said Bradley, who is a professor of genetics population at Trinity College, Dublin. We think ancient Irish populations would be similar to Cheddar Man, he continued. The current very light skin we have in Ireland now is at the end point of thousands of years of surviving in a climate where there's very little sun. It's an adaptation to the need to synthesize vitamin D in the skin. It has taken thousands of years for it to become like it is today. Research shows that Cheddar Man's tribe may have migrated to Britain at the end of the last ice age, as researchers found DNA similarities between his skeletal remains and people from Spain, Luxembourg, and Hungary. Scientists were also able to find clues that could suggest nearly 30 to 40,000 people were living on the island of Ireland during the era when darker skin was common, the Irish Post noted. This article was titled, "Ireland's Earliest Inhabitants were black people with blue eyes. They lived on the island for nearly 4,000 years before settled farmers took over. Written by Shannon Dawson, News 1, March 17, 2025. The next article is titled, Interracial Love in the Shadow of Politics. Written by Josh Rogers, Ebony, February 19, 2025. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner wasn't just a movie. It was a mirror reflecting the tension between love and the boundaries society dares us not to cross. That movie became an exposition of interracial dating and showed us that it is always more than a personal choice, a collision of love, history, and power. It challenges societal boundaries and reveals how politics, identity, and culture shape some of our closest connections. The film's dinner table conversation, tense, raw, and uncomfortably honest, still resonates, reminding us that love does not exist in a vacuum. It exists in a world weighed down by prejudice, power, and perception. As a black American from the South, my reflections are not abstract. They are lived. My decision to marry a black woman was about more than love. It was a declaration of cultural alignment and resistance against erasure. I know what it means to be seated at tables where love is questioned and identity becomes a political statement. So I empathize with those whose choices differ from mine. In a time where division is political currency, interracial relationships still face scrutiny, once dramatized on screen. Except now, the stakes feel even higher, and judgment is more public. But if Guess Who's Coming to Dinner taught us anything, love rooted in conviction will constantly challenge the limits of societal acceptance. Back then, it was about daring to love beyond race. Today, it's about daring to love while confronting the forces that try to erase identity, dilute culture, or reduce commitment to a political debate. My choice, my marriage, is personal and political, a love story and a resistance story. And for those who choose to date beyond their racial and ethnic identity, it should have the freedom of the same tone. While many have become more socially accepting of interracial dating, I cannot deny perspectives that raised me. The warnings from elders often carried the wisdom of survival. My mother's admonition, "Don't you bring a white girl to my house," was not about hatred, but protection, a shield from a world where interracial love was once criminalized and punished. A 2022 Murray State report highlights that black love has been an act of defiance, asserting that blackness is not only whole but sacred, and the reality of defiance of societal norms can be doubly true for those in interracial partnerships. Ashley O'Day, a wife and mother in an interracial marriage, said, "The most rewarding part of being in an interracial marriage is being fully seen by my spouse. But the most challenging is explaining the struggles black people face daily. Love across racial differences requires more than affection. It demands labor of listening, confronting privilege, and unlearning assumptions. Cultural norms, traditions, and family expectations often compound this complexity. Interracial couples face the challenge of honoring both their individual and collective cultural heritages without losing their distinct identities. The labor extends to bridging worlds, attending family gatherings where differences in race and culture surface through unspoken tensions or confrontation. Moreover, generational trauma often shapes the lens through which interracial relationships are viewed. For black families, the warnings against crossing racial boundaries were usually about safety, both physical and emotional. Navigating these layered histories requires patience and empathy, recognizing that while personal love is never free from social and historical context. In Trump's America, love is entangled with politics. The ACLU warns that the rollback of Roe v. Wade could open the doors to challenges against Loving v. Virginia, the ruling that legalized interracial marriage. This signals a truth. Right-like relationships are never safe from political assault. I had the chance to speak to a close friend of mine, a white-identifying man who dates outside his race but prefers to remain anonymous, about his experience in interracial relationships. Anyone dating a person of color might worry how they'll be treated. Certain language from leaders enables hate, making it feel louder and more present, he observed. His words remind us that political rhetoric emboldens hostility, making public spaces riskier for interracial couples. The political climate also forces couples to confront how their relationship is perceived through racialized lenses. Policies that target marginalized communities often hit close to home, whether through conversations about political brutality, immigration laws, or education disparities. Love becomes a space where the personal and political collide. The labor of love, in this arena, is about solidarity, showing up for one another, not just as partners, but as allies in a shared struggle against injustice. Author Bell Hooks reminds us, since anti-racist individuals did not control mass media, the media became the primary tool used to convince black viewers and everyone else of black inferiority. Media loves the optics of interracial couples, but reduces them to symbols of a post-racial ideal, erasing their struggles. That's not fair. A 2024 phys.org report, phys.org, notes that ads featuring interracial families often spark applause and outcry, proof that society remains uneasy with what such relationships represent. Yet the curated depictions mask the lived reality, microaggressions, assumptions, and the strain of constantly educating others. The lack of diverse storytelling in media also erases the range of interracial experiences. Stories are often white-centered, depicting interracial relationships primarily as white / non-white pairings, ignoring the complexities within relationships between people of color. This narrow lens flattens experiences, furthering the stereotype that interracial love exists solely to resolve racial tension rather than explore the depth of connection. Additionally, media portrayals often commodify blackness within interracial relationships. Black partners are depicted as the source of culture, strength, or style, but rarely as fully complex individuals with their own desires and flaws. This performance representation fuels harmful narratives rather than honoring the full humanity of both partners, and sadly, it becomes a media blueprint for public discourse in politics and beyond. This article was titled Interracial Love in the Shadow of Politics. It's a public opinion piece by Josh Rogers, Ebony, February 19th, 2025. That's all the time we have for the African American Hour. My name is Rosemary Onkwe. Thanks for joining me.